From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
More women have been fighting in the Iraq War than in any other war in American history, but at the same time, they're not being treated equally to men. They're taking as many risks, but they have not only the risks of war, but also the risks of being sexually assaulted, abused, and harassed by their own soldiers.
On this International Women's Day, we'll take a look at the private war of women soldiers with Professor Helen Benedict and with Native American Iraq War vet Ellie Painted Crow.
I would hear statements, briefings from officers calling enemy territory Indian country. And I found that very shocking. Here I was sitting on the side and I would wonder, well, what side should I be on then if this is Indian country? Perhaps I'm on the wrong side.
Also, Academy Award-winning actress Gina Davis on women, girls, and the media.
To think, what message is our culture still sending to kids? That women and girls are worth less, and their worth is different than men and boys.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The day-to-day commander of U.S. troops in Iraq is recommending the Pentagon maintain its increased troop levels for at least another year. The proposal would mean 160,000 U.S. troops in Iraq through February 2008. The New York Times reports Lieutenant General Raymond Odierno made the confidential assessment to the top U.S. commander in Iraq, General David Petraeus. Petraeus has yet to issue his own recommendation. The news comes as the Pentagon has announced it's approved a request to send another 2,200 military police to Iraq. The increase comes on top of the 21,500 troops and 2,400 support troops ordered by President Bush earlier this year. The Pentagon says it needs the additional military police to handle an anticipated rise in Iraqi prisoners during the crackdown on Baghdad. Meanwhile, in Washington, Democrats are meeting today over a plan that would require the withdrawal of U.S. combat troops by the fall of next year. The plan calls for an earlier timetable if the Iraqi government fails to meet security goals. President Bush is in Brazil today for the first stop of his Latin American tour. On Wednesday, the president explained his hopes for the trip.
You know, oftentimes people really don't understand the United States, and my trip is to really explain to people that we believe in education for all. We believe in human rights and human dignity. We believe in prosperity, and the people of this country have been very generous in their help and support to people.
After Brazil, the president will touch down in Uruguay, Colombia, Guatemala, and Mexico. In Colombia, thousands of people turned out Wednesday for a protest ahead of Bush's visit. Demonstrators burnt American flags and scuffled with police. Several protests are expected throughout Latin America during President Bush's six-day tour. Iran has rejected a new European Union request that it take a time out from nuclear activity to avoid international sanctions. This is Ali Asghar Soltania, Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency.
We don't find any technical legal ground for it. And after all, we have said that we cannot start negotiating with precondition. This is not legal, and this is not justified. It's not fair. We can immediately start. And we invite them to immediately sit down at the negotiating table, and all issues could be discussed with the parties concerned. We have not even limited the parties concerned.
On Capitol Hill, King Abdullah of Jordan continued his visit to the U.S. Wednesday with an address before a joint session of Congress. Abdullah called on the U.S. to support Palestinian self-determination.
60 years of Palestinian dispossession, 40 years under occupation, a stop-and-go peace process. All this has left a bitter legacy of disappointment and despair on all sides. It is time to create a new and different legacy, one that begins right now.
King Abdullah says the U.S. should back the Saudi peace plan advanced by the Arab states. The proposal calls for recognition of Israel in return for a full Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories. In the Senate, Democrats have announced they're planning to subpoena five senior Justice Department officials as part of the investigation into the dismissals of eight U.S. attorneys. Those called to testify likely include the chief of staff to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico has hired a defense attorney as the scandal unfolds. His choice has raised eyebrows. Domenici's new lawyer is Kaylee Blalock. Blalock represented the jailed former Republican Congress member Randy Duke Cunningham in his corruption case. Cunningham's prosecutor, Carol Lamb of San Diego, was among the eight U.S. attorneys to lose their jobs. Some have speculated Lamb was ousted as punishment for leading the case against Cunningham. In Vermont, nearly 30 towns have passed a resolution calling for the impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. The measure says the administration misled the country into the invasion of Iraq and violated the Constitution. The resolution comes on the heels of last month's call by Vermont's legislature for the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. The Bush administration has given a new contract to the private military contractor DynCorp. On Wednesday, the State Department announced DynCorp has been hired to help equip and support the international peacekeeping force in Somalia. The $10 million contract means the U.S. can maintain its role in Somalia without committing combat troops. The European Union's meeting today to decide on its emission proposals for the next negotiating round of the Kyoto Accords. The EU says it would agree to reduce emissions to 30% of 1990 levels if other countries join in. Former Vice President Al Gore was in Brussels Wednesday to urge the EU to take the lead.
Well, the European Union has such an important and critical leadership role to play. And I'm trying to get my country to change its policies, but in the meantime, the European Union is absolutely key to helping the world make the change it must.
Back in the United States, a reading of the play The Vagina Monologues has led to the suspension of three female high school students in upstate New York. The students at John Jay High were suspended for including the word vagina in their performance. One of the students was supposed to serve her suspension Wednesday, but was told it's been postponed pending a review. Another of the three, Megan Reback, said, quote, "What did we do that was so wrong? We were insubordinate, but the reason we were insubordinate was that we talked about our body." In Massachusetts, around 100 young children were left without their parents this week after a massive immigration raid on a leather goods factory employing undocumented workers. Immigration officials say more than 300 were detained, most of them women. The company, Michael Bianco Incorporated, has been accused of employing workers in sweatshop-like conditions. Pregnant workers and some other workers with children have been released. And finally, women around the world are gathering to mark International Women's Day in the Philippines. Hundreds of women rallied in Manila against a recent anti-terror law. Riot police blocked them from marching on the presidential palace. In Bangladesh, women's groups took part in rallies in Dhaka. In the occupied territories, hundreds of Palestinian women were joined by Palestinian men for a march on an Israeli military checkpoint in the West Bank city of Nablus. The woman-led march called for the release of prisoners from Israeli jails and the lifting of the international boycott on the Palestinian government. And in Spain, 500 women have gathered for a summit of African and Spanish female leaders in Madrid. Those attending include Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and the Kenyan Nobel laureate Wangari Maathai. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is March 8th, International Women's Day. Millions around the world are marking it by celebrating advances made by women and to honor the ongoing global struggle for gender equality and equal rights. One of those struggles is taking place within the U.S. military. In the United States, there are more women serving in the armed forces than in any other period in American history. More than 160,000 female U.S. soldiers have served in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Middle East since 2003, which means one in seven soldiers are women. At least 450 women have been wounded in Iraq. 71 have died, more female casualties and deaths than in the Korean, Vietnam, and first Gulf Wars combined. With the increased number of women serving in the U.S. military, something else is on the rise, too. Rape and sexual assault by their male comrades. To make matters worse, female soldiers say they can't trust the U.S. military to protect them. Specialist Michaela Montoya came face to face with the dangers of rape by her male comrades when she was deployed to Iraq with the National Guard in 2005. She joins me on the line from California. Joining me in our Firehouse studio is Helen Benedict, a professor of Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. She's author of three books on sexual assault, including Recovery, How to Survive Sexual Assault, and Virgin or Vamp, How the Press Covers Sex Crimes. She's currently working on a book about women veterans of the Iraq War. Her latest article at Salaam.com is called The Private War of Women Soldiers. And in San Francisco, we're joined by Ellie Painted Crow. She served in the Army for 22 years, including time in Iraq in 2004. She's the mother of two sons who served in the military and has seven grandchildren. She's also a member of the Aki Nation in Tucson, Arizona. And we welcome you all to Democracy Now! Helen Benedict, why don't we begin with you? What is the private war of women soldiers?
It's partly to be treated equally, but it's mostly to feel safe. Harassment is almost universal throughout, sexual harassment throughout the military. Sometimes it's more severe than others, but it mounts up. The stress of being constantly pressured for sex and constantly teased makes it very hard to do one's job, and it's something that the men, very few men, have to put up with. But there's also the danger of sexual assault and rape, and all the soldiers I've talked to are very well aware of that. So they don't not only have to worry about the dangers of war, incoming fire and so on, but the danger of assault from the very people they're supposed to trust.
In your survey of women, what have you found in terms of numbers? How pervasive is this?
The numbers are very hard to assess because so few people wish to come forth. There is a study of earlier veterans of war that indicates 30% of women are sexually assaulted and or raped. There are other studies that put the numbers less and some that put them high. The military itself only counts reported rapes by women while they're still in the military, so their numbers are much lower because the climate's very difficult to report in. Sexual assault is higher because more, which includes attempted rape but not fully completed, and sexual harassment is up to 90%. That's what I found in my studies.
Ellie Painted Crow, how long have you been in the Army altogether?
A total of 22 years. I retired in November of 2005.
You served in Iraq and Kuwait in 2004?
Yes.
What did you find when it came to sexual abuse, to rape?
What I saw was a lot of inequities in terms of how female soldiers are treated. There was an actual rape case on the base that I was assigned to, and the way that they handled it was they moved the perpetrator to another site, and unfortunately I didn't get to stay on that base camp to find out what ultimately happened to the female. I know that she reported it, and it was supposed to be private, and before you knew it, everybody knew what was going on. So it wasn't as confidential and private in terms of investigating or protecting her as a soldier there. And so it was shaming, you know.
Describe the overall climate in Iraq. What kind of tone is set, and how did you deal with it, Ellie Painted Crow?
Well, I think that every base has its own climate depending on what's going on in the area. I was able to stay in a base camp for a very short time that there were plenty of females to at least, you know, they tell you you have to have a battle buddy and you have to, you know, go to the latrine. You can't go alone. And when I moved to another base camp, what I found, it was a transitional base camp where soldiers would come in, refuel, spend the night, and I found companies coming in with just one female for the whole company, and she had no battle buddy, and nobody even bothered to look at that for these females that were moving and moving out with these other, you know, male soldiers. There was no support for them, and nobody considered that.
Professor Benedict, you write about the number of women that you surveyed, and particularly, for example, walking to the latrine.
Yes, quite a few of them told me that they were ordered to not go out at night alone and not to go to the latrines or the showers without a buddy, without another woman. This was not being told to the men, and the problem was that there often weren't other women to choose, as Ellie Painted Crow just said, or it entailed waking somebody up in the middle of the night to get them to go with you. And the soldiers are working 12 hours a day on the whole out there. They're getting almost no sleep. They wake up all night long for one reason or another. So having to wake somebody up because you need to go to the bathroom is not as light as it may sound. But also they felt that it was a universal recognition that it was dangerous for women out there, and they weren't talking about danger from the Iraqis. They were talking about, as I've said, danger from their fellow soldiers.
I want to turn to a clip of Colonel Janice Karpinski. She's best known for her role as commander of the Abu Ghraib prison, but she's also spoken out on the treatment of female soldiers in Iraq. Last year, she testified at a mock trial known as the Bush Crimes Commission hearings.
Because the women, in fear of getting up in the hours of darkness to go out to the portalettes or the latrines, were not drinking liquids after 3 or 4 in the afternoon. And in 120-degree heat, or warmer, because there was no air conditioning at most of the facilities, they were dying from dehydration in their sleep. And rather than make everybody aware of that, because that's shocking, and as a leader, if that's not shocking to you, then you're not much of a leader. So what they told the surgeon to do was don't brief those details anymore. And don't say specifically that they're women. You can provide that in a written report, but don't brief it in the open anymore.
Was there a commander who saw dehydration listed as a cause of death of a woman, female U.S. soldier, and after that he said, do not list dehydration as a cause of death anymore?
Yes.
Who was that?
General Sanchez.
General Sanchez. Thank you.
That was Colonel, formerly Brigadier General Janice Karpinski, being questioned by the law professor Marjorie Cohen. The general she's referring to is Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who served as the commander of the coalition forces in Iraq. Professor Benedict, you write about what Janice Karpinski, what the former Brigadier General demoted after the Abu Ghraib scandal, had to say.
Yes. We talked about it, actually, because I wanted to check with her, because the Army has said that her claims were unsubstantiated. And she described sitting there with the doctor while he explained why these women had died of dehydration. And
they died of dehydration?
They died of dehydration, which, it's quite common for soldiers out there to have serious health problems because of the heat and dehydration. You have to drink liters of water every day to be all right. It's so hot.
And they were simply afraid to go out alone to get the water,
and
being harassed.
She told me, and this is something more detailed than came out in what you just showed, that there were men who were waiting out there, and they were pulling the women into the latrines and abusing them and raping them there. And that's this word had spread about this, and that's why the women were afraid to go out. And I went to the site, the Iraq casualty site, which lists all the deaths, and I did indeed find 3 deaths of women in the year she was talking about attributed to non-hostile causes, which the Army never seems to really explain. So I think it's very possible those are the 3 she was talking about.
We're talking to Professor Helen Benedict, also to Sergeant Ellie Painted Crow, and we're also joined on the phone by Specialist Michaela Montoya, deployed to Iraq with the National Guard in 2005. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Can you talk about your own experience in Iraq?
Well, it sounded really similar to the experiences that you explained. I didn't know that it was that common at the time. I kind of just got used to it and dealt with it and tried to figure out a way around the restroom issue.
How did you figure out your way around going to the bathroom?
I would still drink, because I would still drink the 3 liters of water usually every day, but I would, a lot of the females were like cutting off the tops of the bottles and in the middle of the night peeing in that and waiting till the morning to dump it out so that we would prevent having to wake up in the middle of the night and go out in the dark because it's so dark at night.
You carried a knife with you?
Yeah, and I would carry a knife with me later on.
For what purpose?
Just to feel safe because, I mean, you can't, I just felt safer that way.
Safe from the Iraqis?
No, safe from the other soldiers. I never intended on using the knife for an Iraqi. I had my M16 for that, but my knife, I always just kept it for another soldier because anytime I would have any type of strong sexual harassment, words spoken, it just made me feel a little bit more secure, and it was visible to the other soldiers.
Did anything specifically happen to you?
Yeah, that's why I would carry the knife. I remember it was really late, and they don't have electricity, so we run off generators, and if you scream or if you were to yell for help or anything like that, nobody could hear you because you're not going to shoot a comrade because these are your supposed battle buddies. So I would just use the knife as, I guess, a scare tactic, and it worked for me because after that I never really had a problem.
Ellie Painted Crow, who could determine the environment for the women? What could ultimately affect it, change it for a woman soldier?
I think being able to report something anonymously would help.
Michaela Montoya.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
Oh, I think that being able to help, being able to report things anonymously would help because it would make you feel a little bit more secure on reporting things. But I don't really know. I can't think of a good solution.
We're going to go to break, and then I'm going to put that question to Sergeant Ellie Painted Crow and also to Dr. Helen Benedict. What can make the difference, and what kind of climate is set at the top at the Pentagon? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org on this International Women's Day. Back in a minute. Agolo, Angelique Kidjo, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our transcripts of all the shows are also there, and our headlines are also in Spanish, in audio and transcript form for any radio station to take. As we talk today on this International Women's Day about women at war, in fact, that's the title of the forthcoming book of Professor Helen Benedict, professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, who's written three other books on sexual assault and abuse. We're also joined on the telephone from Los Angeles by specialist Michaela Montoya, who is deployed to Iraq with the National Guard in 2005. Sergeant Ellie Painted Crow joins us in San Francisco. She served 22 years in the Army, served in Iraq and Kuwait in 2004. The setting of the climate, Sergeant Painted Crow, who could determine how a unit, an atmosphere for women would be?
Who could determine the women themselves? It's very difficult to even for me to address that question. You just go in, there's so much disorganizing, that's probably the last thing on anybody's mind, any commander's mind, in terms of the women and how they're going to be treated. There's such a lack of education on sexual assault by the commanders, by the soldiers, and even a lot of the times by the female, of as to why that happens. And we're in a hostile environment. So to imagine that when you teach a soldier to hate and to be violent, that you can control that on any level is very difficult. You have to remember that soldier, you're going over there to kill, we're going over there. We lose a lot of values when you're out there. And so you become this predator, this aggressor, this whole thing that just doesn't work out what you consider the enemy. It just becomes who you are. So what can you expect? I mean, there are no measures there that speak about women having to, I mean, nobody thinks about you have to protect yourself from your peers. But nobody thinks about that. But you really end up, they end up being a lot of the times, you know, what you have to take care of yourself from the most, more than what you're dealing with outside the base camp.
Professor Helen Benedict, what is the Pentagon doing about this?
They've set up a sexual assault website which gives directions not to soldiers on how to report a sexual assault, either anonymously or not anonymously, and it defines it. And they also are now holding classes on what sexual harassment is. Very often, if there is a report of an assault, the first response is to hold one of these classes. The trouble is, all the soldiers I've talked to say that this is just a kind of cosmetic. The reality is you can't report it anonymously. These are closed societies full of gossip. Everybody knows what's going on, as you've already heard. And also, the leadership don't really want to hear about this because it disrupts the chain of command. It undermines morale. So the result is that most soldiers don't say anything, and when they do, they're shut up.
You talk about the tone being set in Iraq and what a difference it makes when a commanding officer says no in his entire unit.
Yes, I've talked to quite a lot of soldiers who did feel perfectly all right. I mean, I don't want to suggest that everybody's being assaulted. I think almost everybody's being harassed, but not every woman is assaulted. The majority aren't. And there are a lot of soldiers out there who are male soldiers who treat the women as their sisters, just as they treat the other men as their brothers, and who are wonderful and reliable people. And the majority of them are like that. But the tone of that is really affected very strongly by the tone of the commanders. I mean, it does come from the top down a lot. And if the commanders and women are just as bad as this, at this as men, turn a blind eye to it or refuse to take it seriously or even indulge in it themselves, it being assault and harassment, then the message gets spread pretty fast that it's okay. And vice versa, if there's no toleration of that, I want my women treated, platoon treated with the same respect and equality as the men, and I won't put up with anything else, that can help a lot.
I want to turn to what you describe as the most shocking case of military sexual assault, that of Army Special Suzanne Swift. She was arrested and confined to base for going AWOL in 2006 after charges of sexual harassment and assault went unaddressed by the military. She says she was sexually harassed and abused by her commanders in Iraq and here at home. We interviewed Suzanne Swift in September. She spoke about what happened to her.
There's an equal opportunity representative for every company in the Army. They all have one, and they're supposed to report it. And everything that you tell them that has to do with equal opportunity, they're supposed to report it no matter what. No matter what happens, even if there's no action taken, they have to report it.
So, did they report it in your case?
No.
So what did you do?
Nothing. I didn't know. I was, you know, brand new to the Army and just basically got thrown into the mix of this company and then sent to Iraq. So I had no idea what to do.
Was there more than one officer involved?
Right. Well, the one that I tried to report was my platoon sergeant. And, you know, looking back now, I had a squad leader who literally singled me out to be the person that he was going to have sex with during a deployment. And, you know, I did. I was 19. I fell for it. And for months, I was like his little sex toy, I guess. It was disgusting and it was horrible, and I didn't know what to do.
And so ultimately, what happened?
Ultimately, I stopped it. I told him that I didn't want to continue this relationship, and he made my life hell. I mean, a squad leader in the Army is basically, that's your boss. They're everything that you do, eat, sleep, go to the bathroom, when you go to work, everything. They can tell you when to do it and how to do it. And he made my life miserable because I wouldn't have sex with him anymore.
Specialist Suzanne Swift, when she came back from Iraq, she was then going to be redeployed and she was getting ready to go. But then as she was making her way to the car, she said to her mother, she just couldn't do it. And she went AWOL. The Eugene police came to her house, to her mother's house, and they arrested her. They handcuffed her, and then she was put back on the base in Fort Lewis. She called her mother, and she said she was put under the supervision of one of the officers who had abused her. Professor Helen Benedict, the latest in Suzanne Swift's case, she was court-martialed.
She was court-martialed. She was offered a deal initially. If she would sign a statement saying that she had never been raped in the Army, they would just give her a summary court-martial, which means a reprimanding letter in the file. She refused to sign that, saying she wouldn't let them make her lie. And so she was court-martialed. She served a month in prison December. And she was told she had to stay in the Army for another 2 years. She was moved to Fort Irwin, I believe, which is very far away from her family, and she may be redeployed.
This is International Women's Day. Sergeant Ellie Painted Crow, I wanted to take this a little broader. Why did you join the military 22 years ago? And not only as a woman, as a Native American woman, your experiences?
Well, economic reasons was a very big factor for me in joining the military, and it's also something that Native people find great honor in and great pride in, and it's very hard to find things that, you know, bring honor to your family and things like that, and so when you join the military, it feels very good for the family, and it was also a way for me to raise my children and to provide for them.
How high a percentage of Native Americans join the military? Is it a big number?
Well, as far as indigenous people go, it's a very big number, proportionate, you know, as far as Natives go. That's like what all of us do. That's our entryway to take care of our families. That's our way to our last resort of holding on to that idea of being a warrior, being a provider, being a protector. And so that is a really big deal for Native. I mean, you go to any ceremony as far as powwows go, things like that, the first thing they do is they call a veterans group to come in and post the colors as a way to honor Native soldiers who are serving and have served.
Why did you feel it was important to join the military?
Well, at the time, it was very, very difficult for me to realize how I was going to raise my children, and I always felt like I needed to be in a place that I could learn some discipline and, you know, really finish something that I'd started, and so I decided to do that. And actually, it was very encouraged when I went to see my recruiter. I was divorced at the time, and my recruiter suggested very strongly, she said, He said, you need to be married or you need to give your children up. Well, I couldn't give my children up. He goes, well, if you have a piece of paper that says you're married, then you can join. And so I looked for my ex-husband, and we remarried so that I could do this, so that I could become part of this military thing. And the illusion around that, as far as what I thought I was getting, I joined the military to get off of welfare. And after 22 years of service, I found, and coming home from Iraq and not being supported by the VA or by any of the things that they said I was going to have as a retired soldier, I ended up on welfare. So I went full circle here. I ended up on general assistance coming home on $258 a month is what I had to live on. And I had to literally write letters to like so many places just to get any kind of help, just to get some doors opened. And I can tell you that most people give up. Most people give up because it's so hard to get help. And what I had going for me was that I just had skills in terms of knowing systems. And after 22 years, you learn a thing or two about systems and you really look at language. So that is what helped me. And I developed a support system of women who also encouraged me to work on this. But I was ready to lose my house, I lost all my friends initially when I first came back because nobody could understand what was wrong with me. And nobody could hear me, and I couldn't speak it, and I couldn't participate in the world. So it was really difficult. So this whole joining of the Army for me, the military, I thought was going to be this, I mean, so great. I had my son sign up for it. That was like my youngest son did 11 years, and my oldest son did 2 years. And in the end, we're all broken. My son is broken behind that. He was in an accident and almost died, and in a wheelchair. And I've had to fight for services for him at our VA office because they refuse to help him in so many ways. He doesn't fit the criteria that the VA designs for certain types of help. He doesn't, they have all this criteria, and then they make memos to budget the money for that VA based on that regulation, but they just redesign it to help themselves. And unless you know that and challenge that, they just say, oh, well, you can't get this help. And soldiers who are so used to taking orders and accepting, you know, you're used to that. They tell you, do this, do that, you do it. And if they tell you, you can't do it, you can't have it, you don't argue it. And so even when you get out, you're in that frame mind. And so many soldiers, young soldiers who don't know the rules, who don't know the laws, who don't know what their rights are, accept what is given to them as far as, oh, you don't qualify for this. So there's just so much.
How did you end up becoming a peace activist, Sergeant Paintacre?
Well, this is very important for me because being Native, I don't see this as a war, number one. And I see this as an invasion that's committing a genocide to a nation, to a people. I see that we are over there and we are doing the same thing that we did here with the indigenous people of this land, calling it democracy, calling it freedom. Well, it isn't freedom if it's imposed. And what I learned about the Iraqi people while I was there was they're very much like the indigenous people here. They have clans, they have circles, they have their ceremonies, they have their drum. There are so many similarities, and it just really hurt me to realize that here I'm a survivor of this attempted genocide on my people. And I say attempted because we're still here, even though they want to say we're not, we're a race. We're not even in the history books. And here I am over there doing the same thing that was done to me.
You said that in the military they referred to Iraq as Indian country?
Yeah, well, they referred to what they said in the briefing, what they called enemy territory, Indian country. And I'm standing there just listening to this briefing, and I'm just in shock that after all this time, after so many Natives have served and are serving and are dying, that we are still the enemy, even if we're wearing the same uniform. That was very shocking for me to hear.
I wanted to ask Specialist Michaela Montoya why you joined the military.
I joined when I was 17. They had a lot of recruiters at my school, and I wasn't doing too great in school, and I needed some type of guidance, and I needed something, a way to pay for college, and I decided to join, and I was pretty satisfied in the beginning until later. I joined the National Guard to get the feel of the military because I wasn't sure if I was ready to be active duty. And now I find myself, I've been in 4 years, and I've been active duty more than half of the time that I've been in. And it's not what I signed up for. But I just pretty much joined for the, I guess, direction.
You are 7.5 months pregnant now?
Yeah.
How much longer will you be in the military?
I put my paperwork in to get out of the military when I was 4 months, and I'm still waiting on the paperwork.
Professor Helen Benedict, you have some remarkable statistics in the article you did for Salon.com, The Private War of Women, of Women Soldiers. Can you talk about the statistics from Vietnam to now on sexual assault?
Yes, most of the statistics have been gathered through studies with veterans who feel freer to talk than when they're still in the military. And a lot of the studies have gathered women who've come to the VA for help for various things, who are veterans from the Vietnam War and all the wars up through now. And that's where I found the 30% said they were raped. I found a 71%
from Vietnam through the first Gulf War, 30%.
Yes, so that includes Bosnia and other places.
2004 study of veterans from Vietnam and all the wars since who are seeking help for post-traumatic stress disorder found 71%
said they were sexually assaulted, yeah.
Sexually assaulted or raped while in the military. And a third study conducted 92-93 with female veterans of the Gulf War and earlier wars, 90% said they'd been sexually harassed?
Harassed, yes. There are no statistics on Iraq alone at the moment. Those are still being studied, but that's what from previous wars and combinations of wars.
What protection does the military provide?
There's no protection. I can't think of a single thing that I would call protection realistically.
And how did you decide to write this book? You've written books on sexual assault before. How did you come to this?
Through Michaela, who we've just been talking to originally. I met her and another young soldier, and the first thing they said to me was, there are only three things the men let you be in the military, a bitch, a hoe, or a dyke. And then they immediately started talking about how they were harassed and how they were treated by men and how the world in general doesn't recognize them or respect them for what they've done as soldiers. And that's what ignited my interest. I mean, my book isn't just about sexual assault. It's going to be about the whole arc of experience, including why people sign up in the first place and their consciences, which is a very important part of it. But this element is making it so horrendously unfair and so much harder on women in a situation that's already horrible that something has to be done about it.
Professor Helen Benedict, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Specialist Michaela Montoya, thank you. Sergeant Ellie Paintedcrow, I want to ask where your son is seeking help, at which VA?
Fresno VA.
And so as you watch these hearings and listen to the news coming out around them, have you been able to contact them to let people know what your own son is going through?
Well, I've written many letters. I've written letters to Capitol Hill. I've written letters to I've contacted my congressman. I've even written letters to the governor. I've had meetings with the director of the Fresno VA. I mean, my son is finally getting the help that he needs, the mental health help, the medication, because he has a closed brain injury, the transportation. But it took me months to do it, and it's in between the time that I need for healing myself. So, I mean, Fresno is just a very small, minute, BA in comparison to the Fort Bliss, Medical Hold, Walter Reed.
Sergeant Ellie Painted Crow, we're going to have to leave it there, but we will definitely continue to follow your story as well as the story of your son. Thank you all for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Stay with us.
For a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines, and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There are shadows on the faces of the ones who send the guns to the wars that are fought in places where the business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and TV, you hear one thing again and again.
Holly Neer singing Lives in the Balance here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman as we continue our coverage on International Women's Day. We turn now to the Oscar-winning actor Gina Davis. She starred in many films, including Thelma and Louise and A League of Their Own. Gina Davis is also founder of the organization See Jane. It works to increase the percentages of female characters and reduce gender stereotyping in media made for children. Gina Davis recently spoke at the National Conference for Media Reform in Memphis, Tennessee. She began by talking about her film Thelma and Louise.
We were totally unprepared for the reaction that the movie got. Like, before the movie came out, for example, if I was at the cleaners or something, somebody might say, oh, you know what? I actually loved Earth Girls Are Easy. Or, you know, something like that. After was night and day. Suddenly, women were coming up to me and saying, that movie changed my life. Oh, my God, you have no idea. My girlfriend and I reenacted your trip. one time I was parked at a red light, and I heard this wild honking next to me, and it was a car full of women leaning out the windows in the sunroof going, woo-hoo! And this had not happened to me before. I mean, you may remember when it came out. It was on the cover of Time magazine a week after it came out. There were passionate editorials about, oh, my God, what's happened now? You know, women have guns. we kill a rapist and ourselves. It's not exactly. But if I ever had needed a lesson in the power of media images, I certainly had it now. And the very next movie I made was A League of Their Own, where suddenly... where suddenly the same phenomenon is happening, but now with 13-year-old girls coming up to me and saying, oh, my God, that movie changed my life. I play sports because of that movie. So this was a huge 1-2 punch for me. And from then on, I really have tried to make my choices thinking of the women that are going to be watching the films that I make, hopefully playing characters they can identify with, feel inspired by, and maybe, I hope again someday, say, woohoo! So here's me with all this heightened awareness. I became a mother. I have a four and a half year old daughter, Alizé, who's watching right now online. And 2-year-old twin boys. So So I started watching videos and programs made for really little kids with them a couple of years ago, and I was stunned to see that there was nearly the same gender imbalance now, with notable exceptions like Dora the Explorer, as when I was a kid, as when we were kids. Do you remember the kinds of stuff that they made for us, for kids, in the oldie old days? The first animation, of course, was Disney stuff, Minnie Mouse, and where is she? I'm pushing the button. Daisy Duck, who didn't really do much at all except ask to go shopping, I think. There were a lot of Hanna-Barbera cartoons, McGilla Gorilla, Wally Gator, George of the Jungle, virtually no female characters. I had a vague recollection that Yogi Bear had a girlfriend, and I searched and searched, and I finally found her, Cindy Bear, as you all remember. Winnie the Pooh has been around for a long time, and still is, has 9 characters, and one of them is female, Kanga. I couldn't find a picture on the internet of her alone without Roo in her pocket. And if you think about it, really, isn't she sort of half a character? Kanga, Roo, you know? She doesn't do things on her own, really. On the Looney Tunes website, they list 12 characters, and only one of them is female, but it's the great one. It's the one you all love and remember the best, Granny. She's the one who owns Tweety, and she has to leave so that the story can happen. Now, we all know that kids get a very strong message about body image from the media. 78% of senior girls say they don't like their bodies. A third of third graders have been on a diet. Which leads me to this question. Is Judy Jetson too thin? I think her waist is the same size as her neck. In that picture, if I'm not wrong. No, I can see you. I saw you for a second, and then you went away. So a lot of kids' fare from back then and even now shows highly stereotyped, sexualized female characters, even in programs made for the youngest kids. For example, did you know Miss Piggy had cleavage? But by far, my absolute favorite is the Smurfs. You remember the Smurfs? Smurfette. This was fairly recent. This was like from the 80s, 1980 to 1990. The website explains that there were 100 Smurfs, and originally there were no female Smurfs. Not sure how that happened. But eventually they added Smurfette, and this is how she originally looked. They describe her as having stringy hair and ugly eyelashes. She was created by an evil wizard to destroy the Smurfs. But then, I'm not kidding, Papa Smurf, after a successful operation of plastic Smurfery, turned her into the blonde bombshell that we all know and love. And it notes that after her appearance improved, the Smurfs accepted and loved her. Okay. So here I am a couple of years back. I'm watching these shows and movies with my daughter, and I'm counting on my fingers the number of male characters and female characters. And I soon run out of fingers on my left hand, and I decide I'd like to do something about this because I really feel like people aren't aware and it's not being addressed. I'm a trustee of the Women's Sports Foundation, so I called my friend Donna Lopiano, the director there, and many of you will find this funny. I said, how do you start a foundation anyway? And she said, well, don't. Don't start a foundation. It's too hard. But try to find one that has similar goals as you, and you could make a program with them. So she introduced me to Dads and Daughters, which is a great national nonprofit organization. Works to improve images of girls in the media. And together we founded See Jane. The very first thing we did was to raise enough funds to sponsor the largest content analysis study ever done of G-rated movies. This was at Annenberg School for Communication, because we thought without the hard facts, it's going to be hard to convince people. We don't want to go in to the people who make these programs and movies and say, our impression is that there are fewer female characters. We wanted the results and the data, and the results were stunning, in fact. Three out of four characters in G-rated movies are male. We studied the top 100 movies released from 1990 to 2005. Of characters shown in groups, only 17% were female. And of the few female characters that were in these movies, most of them were highly stereotyped. And by the way, during this 15-year period, there was zero improvement as far as the percentage of female characters. So you have to think, what message is our culture still sending to kids? That women and girls are worth less, and their worth is different than men and boys. What if, partly because the media children are seeing from the very beginning, programming that's aimed at our very youngest kids, have this huge imbalance? It's affecting them when they're adults. I'd like to find out. So armed with our study, we've had meetings with studio executives and entities that make movies and television programs for kids. And we've had a very positive response. And in fact, a lot of jaw-dropping. These people, just like an average viewer who really perhaps doesn't notice this, they were not aware of this gender disparity in the product that they're putting out. And they were thunderstruck, in fact, to hear this data. We've also finished the most comprehensive study of TV programs aimed at children. We'll be releasing that soon. And we've moved on to studying PG and PG-13 movies, and they promise some really startling results. So our goal at See Jane is to dramatically increase the percentage of female characters and reduce gender stereotyping. In media that's made for kids 11 and under. And we're going to do it through working with the industry in a collegial way and sharing our information with them, and through a public education campaign. Because, frankly, my dream is in 5 years that if a movie came out that had only one female character, every reviewer would notice, and every parent would notice and say, what the hell is going on here?
Actor Gina Davis speaking at the National Conference for Media Reform in Memphis in January. If you'd like a copy of today's broadcast, you can go to our website and get a DVD at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Ufodo Kaddush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aramate, Jen Yutz, Anuradha Bhagwati, and Megan Whitney, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. Also special thanks to Angela Austin and Uri Valed, Tyshawn Black, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Tori Townsend, Samantha Chamblee. That website, democracynow.org. Have a good International Women's Day. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.